jobs and social reforms, his first medicine, agriculture, and search for world peace and harmony. This is no exaggeration. The first schools were established in Sumer as a direct outgrowth of the invention and introduction of writing. As Sumer's civilization was uncovered, it became clear that the first for a system of laws, for concepts of social order, and for fair administration of justice belonged to Sumer. While the Babylonians made rules and regulations, the Sumerians were concerned with justice, for they believed that the gods appointed the kings primarily to assure justice in the land. The Sumerian concern with justice, or its absence, also found expression in what Professor Kramer called the first Job. Matching together fragments of clay tablets at the Istanbul Museum of Antiquities, Kramer was able to read a good part of a Sumerian poem which, like the biblical book of Job, dealt with the complaint of a righteous man who, instead of being blessed by the gods, was made to suffer all manner of loss and disrespect. "My righteous word has been turned into a lie," he cried out in anguish. In its second part, the anonymous sufferer petitions his God in a manner akin to some of the verses in the Hebrew Psalms. "My God, you who are my Father, who beget me, lift up my face. How long will you neglect me, leave me unprotected, leave me without guidance?" Then follows a happy ending. The righteous words, the pure words uttered by him, his God accepted. His God withdrew his hand from the evil pronouncement. The material and spiritual achievements of the Sumerian civilization were also accompanied by an extensive development of the performing arts. A team of scholars from the University of California at Berkeley made news in March 1974 when they announced that they had deciphered the world's oldest song. "We always knew," the Berkeley team explained, "that there was music in the earlier Assyrio-Babylonian civilization, but until this deciphering, we didn't know that it was the same heptatonic-diatonic scale that is characteristic of contemporary Western music and of Greek music of the first millennium B.C. Until now, it was thought that Western music originated in Greece. Now it's been established that our music, as so much else of Western civilization, originated in Mesopotamia." After excavating at Lagash, the archaeologist Spade uncovered Nippur, the one-time religious center of Sumer and Akkad. At Shuruppak, schoolhouses dating to the 3rd millennium B.C. were found. At Ur, scholars found magnificent vases, jewelry, weapons, chariots, helmets made of gold, silver, copper, and bronze, the remains of a weaving factory, and a towering ziggurat. At Kish, monumental buildings and a ziggurat from at least 3000 B.C. were unearthed. Uruk took the archaeologists back into the 4th millennium B.C. Further south, archaeologists found Urdu, the first Sumerian city. When the Spades came upon the foundations of the first temple, below that was virgin soil. The time was about 3800 B.C. That is when civilization began. Having begun to use the stones as tools some 2 million years earlier, man achieved this unprecedented civilization in about 3800 B.C., and the perplexing fact about this is that to this very day, the scholars have no inkling who the Sumerians were and how and why their civilization appeared. Joseph Campbell summed it up this way: "With stunning abruptness, there appears in this little Sumerian mud garden the whole cultural syndrome that has since constituted the germinal unit of all the high civilizations of the world." What was it that after hundreds of thousands and even millions of years of painfully slow human development abruptly changed everything so completely? One can go further and ask even more. Why did it happen at all? The Sumerians, the people through whom this high civilization so suddenly came into being, had a ready answer. It was summed up by one of the tens of thousands of ancient Mesopotamian inscriptions that have been uncovered. "Whatever seems beautiful, we made by the grace of the gods." The gods of Sumer, who were they? Were the gods of the Sumerians like the Greek gods, who were described as living in a great court, feasting in the great hall of Zeus in the heavens, Olympus, whose counterpart on earth was Greece's highest peak, Mount Olympus? The Greeks described their gods as anthropomorphic, as physically similar to mortal man and woman, and human in character. They could be happy and angry and jealous. They made love, quarreled, fought. They even procreated like humans, bringing forth offspring through sexual intercourse with each other or with humans. They were unreachable, and yet they were constantly mixed up in human affairs. They could travel at immense speeds, appear and disappear. They had weapons of immense and unusual power. Each had specific functions, and as a result, a specific human activity could suffer or benefit by the attitude of the god in charge of that particular activity. Therefore, rituals of worship and offerings to the gods were supposed to gain their favor. But their total number, 12, could not be exceeded. It appears that the number 12 was a requirement. Though Greek mythology was not clear regarding the origins of mankind, the legends and traditions claim descent from the gods for heroes and kings. These semigods form the link between the human destiny, daily toil, dependence on the elements, plagues, illness, death, and a golden past, when only the gods roamed the earth. And although so many of the gods were born on earth, the select circle of 12 Olympians represented the celestial aspect of the gods. The original Olympus was described by the Odyssey as laying in the pure upper air. The original 12 great gods were gods of heaven, would come down to earth, and they represented the 12 celestial bodies in the vault of heaven. The Latin names of the Greek gods given them when the Romans adopted the Greek pantheon clarify their astral association. Gaia was Earth, Hermes, Mercury, Aphrodite, Venus, Ares, Mars, Cronus, Saturn, and Zeus, Jupiter. Continuing the Greek tradition, the Romans envisioned Jupiter as a thundering god whose weapon was the lightning bolt. Like the Greeks, the Romans associated him with the bull. There is now general agreement that the foundations of the distinct Greek civilization were laid on the island of Crete, where the Minoan culture flourished from about 2700 BC to 1400 BC. The Greeks, in fact, never claimed that their Olympian gods came directly to Greece from the heavens. Zeus arrived from across the Mediterranean via Crete. Aphrodite was said to have come by sea from the Near East. Poseidon, Neptune to the Romans, brought the horse with him from Asia Minor. Athena brought the olive, fertile and self-sown, to Greece from the lands of the Bible. There is no doubt that the Greek traditions and religion arrived on the Greek mainland from the Near East via Asia Minor and the Mediterranean islands. It is there that the pantheon had its roots. It is there that we should look for the origin of the Greek gods and their astral relationship with the number 12. Hinduism, the ancient religion of India, considers the Vedas, compositions of hymns, sacrificial formulas, and other sayings pertaining to the gods, as sacred scriptures, not of human origin. The gods themselves composed them, the Hindu tradition says, in the age that preceded the present one. But as time went on, more and more of the original 100,000 verses passed from generation to generation orally were lost and confused. In the end, a sage wrote down the remaining verses, divided them into four books, entrusting four of his principal disciples to preserve one Veda each. When in the 19th century scholars began to decipher and understand forgotten languages and trace the connections between them, they realized that the Vedas were written in a very ancient Indo-European language, the predecessor of the Indian root tongue Sanskrit, of Greek, Latin, and other European languages. When they were finally able to read and analyze the Vedas, they were surprised to see the uncanny similarity between Vedic tales of the gods and the Greek ones. The tales concerning the principal deities, as well as verses dealing with a multitude of other lesser deities, are clearly related to the Greek tales. And in both instances, the circle of the great gods always stood at 12, no matter what changes took place in the divine succession. How could such similarity arise in two areas so far apart, geographically and in time? Scholars believe that sometime in the second millennium BC, a people speaking an Indo-European language and centered in northern Iran, or the Caucasus area, embarked on great migrations. One group went southeast to India. The Hindus call them the Aryans, noble men. They brought with them the Vedas, or oral tales, about 1500 BC. Another wave of this Indo-European migration went westward to Europe. Some circled the Black Sea and arrived in Europe via the steppes of Russia. But the main route by which these people and their traditions and religion reached Greece was the shortest one, Asia Minor. Some of the most ancient Greek cities, in fact, lie not in the Greek mainland, but in the western tip of Asia Minor. But who were these Indo-Europeans who chose Anatolia as their abode? Little in Western knowledge shed light on that subject once again. The only readily available and reliable source proved to be the Old Testament. There, the scholars found several references to the Hittites as the people inhabiting the mountains of Anatolia. Forearmed with clues provided in Egyptian and Mesopotamian texts, the scholars embarked on excavations of ancient sites in Anatolia's hilly regions. The efforts paid off. They found Hittite cities, palaces, royal treasures, royal tombs, temples, religious objects, tools, weapons, art objects. Above all, they found many inscriptions. The biblical Hittites had come to life. A unique monument bequeathed to us by the ancient Near East is a rock carving outside the ancient Hittite capital on which all of the gods of the Hittites were depicted in procession. Marching in from left in a long procession of primarily male deities clearly organized in companies of 12. Much effort was invested by scholars to determine the names, titles, and roles of the deities included in the procession. But it's clear that the Hittite pantheon, too, was governed by the Olympian 12. The lesser gods were organized in groups of 12, and the great gods on earth were associated with 12 celestial bodies. The archaeological finds showed conclusively that the Hittites worshipped gods that were of heaven and earth, all interrelated and arranged in a genealogical hierarchy. Some were great or olden gods who were originally of the heavens. Other gods were actually present, not merely on earth, but among the Hittites, acting as supreme rulers of the land. A long and well-preserved Hittite epic tale entitled Kingship in Heaven deals with the heavenly origin of the gods, thus establishing that the gods of old were both of heaven and upon earth. The epic lists the 12 mighty olden ones, the forebearers of the gods, and proceeds to tell how the god who was king in heaven came to dark-hued earth. A god named Alalu was forcefully deposed from his throne somewhere in the heavens and, fleeing for his life, descended to earth. But that was not the end. The text proceeded to recount how Anu, in turn, was also deposed by a god named Kumarbi, Anu's own brother, by some interpretations. There's no doubt that this epic, written 1,000 years before the Greek legends were composed, was the forerunner of the tale of the deposing of Uranus by Cronus and Cronus by Zeus. Even the detail pertaining to the castration of Cronus by Zeus is found in the Hittite text, for that was exactly what Kumarbi did to Anu. Though emasculated, Anu managed to fly back to his heavenly abode, leaving Kumarbi in control of Earth. Meanwhile, Anu's manhood produced several deities within Kumarbi's insides, which he, like Cronus of the Greek legends, was forced to release. One of these was Teshub, the chief Hittite deity. However, there was to be one more epic battle before Teshub could rule in peace. Did the particular battles fought by Teshub upon earth and in the skies take place when the age of Taurus commenced around 4000 BC? Was it for that reason that the winner was granted association with the bull? And were the events in any way connected with the beginning, at the very same time, of the sudden civilization in Sumer?